You're listening to 95.7 FM, KDRT LP, Davis, California.
I see trees of green, red roses too. I see them bloom for me and you. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world. I see skies of blue and clouds of white, the bright blessed day, the dark sacred night. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world.
And that music means it's time for the Davis Garden Show. This is Don Shore.
And this is Lois Richter on a bright, beautiful, sunny Davis day.
It is bright and beautiful, and we have had some interesting weather here. Today's date is June 26th, 2024. It's late morning, and as Lois and I are preparing this show, it's 68 degrees, which is very, very, very pleasant. Going up to a high, and there's quite a delta breeze coming in today. We've got quite a 7 to 10 days of interesting weather coming up here. So today's day, June 26th, will be 89 degrees. Tonight will be 55 degrees and clear. And Thursday, the day of the broadcast, also 89 degrees, sunny, 55 degrees and clear Thursday night. We realize most of the rest of the country is going through way weirder weather than this. So
Don, I have a problem. You said it's 89 degrees. I'm looking on my iPhone at the weather app, and it says 91 and 95 tomorrow.
Yeah, exactly, which is why I don't use the weather app on my phone. I'm looking at the National Weather Service here, and I've found over the years, the National Weather Service, which looks at several different models and kind of merges them all together, in my opinion, is the most accurate weather forecaster out there. The National Weather Service is what I use. On your phone, you have an app that's based on usually one of the global circulation models, and the Weather Service averages them, I guess is the best way to put it. If you want to see that play out, head on over to, what is it, ventusky.com? Yes, ventusky.com. You can go out days and days, and you can scroll around with your cursor, and you can use the two or three different models that they show there, and you can see the difference. We'll get to that in a moment. But right now, this week, after having had a hot spell a few days ago, one of our typical high temperature for a couple of days, delta breeze rushing in a couple of days later, we're back in the delta breeze phase. Friday's high will be only 92 degrees, which is almost exactly average for this time of year for our region. Friday night will be 56 degrees, also almost exactly average for this time of year. Saturday, 89 degrees and sunny. Saturday night's going to be 58 degrees and clear. Sunday, we start getting into a hot spell, and this is where the weather models diverge. Sunday is going to be 91 degrees, according to the Weather Service, and sunny. You got your model, your weather app open in front of you?
98.
Right. Sunday night, clear with a low around 60. I think they probably agree on that,
64.
Right? Okay. Monday, sunny and hot with a high near 98.
107.
Monday night, clear with a low around 64.
Okay.
Okay, you good with that one? And Tuesday, sunny and hot with a high near 101.
106.
National Weather Service appears to be kind of playing it safe with that extended forecast. There's disagreement between the models, shall we say. So the extended discussion from the Weather Service explains this. The ensembles, which is the general models, are in general agreement that we'll be caught between two ridges with a trough over us as the high pressure builds both to our west and our east. Despite the trough, heights will begin to increase during this time, keeping temperatures near normal through this weekend. By Monday, the ridge means high temperature, over the Pacific begins to encroach on our area, increasing heights even further and beginning what they call a slight warming trend. There is some uncertainty on the strength of this ridge, how it will proceed after the initial buildup. Currently, the National Blend of Models has probabilities of valley temperatures reaching 100 degrees at 50 to 80% on Monday, 75 to 95% on Tuesday, 60 to 90% on Wednesday. There's widespread moderate heat risk currently expected Monday through Wednesday, with small areas of major heat risk, primarily in or near the foothills on Tuesday and Wednesday. Additionally, on Monday, there is a chance for breezy to gusty north and northwesterly winds, which for gardeners, that means dry, with strongest gusts in the northern and central, that's us, Sacramento Valley in the afternoon and evening. So two ridges, we're kind of trapped between them, not exactly sure how they're going to play out. High temperatures building Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, and of course, north wind means dry. So going into next week might be a really good time to give all your shrubs and trees a really good deep soaking. Ahead of that potential heat wave, it could be 101, or apparently it could be 107, who knows? But it's going to be hot and dry after a north wind. My own preference on my farm is to go around and do my valves in groups so that everything gets a really thorough soaking right before we go into that kind of weather. I don't want to be out there in hot weather watering. Also, I don't really like to run water at the base of a plant when it's extremely hot, because it does somewhat increase the risk of crown rot. So I prefer to get that good deep soaking done ahead of time. What that means is, if you've got your system on a timer and things are just on the edge of getting enough water, as we talked about before, just run it again, another cycle on the same day. Or even better, as I've now described to several people over the last few days, go out there and turn it on by hand for a little while, good long soaking for a couple of hours. If you know how to turn your drip line on, or your valve on the little bleeder valve that's on there, just turn it on that way. Go to your timer and run a cycle, whatever is easiest for you. Or as I said to someone yesterday, or just take a hose, turn on a moderate flow, enough that it soaks in, doesn't run off, set it at the base of this plant for a while, a good long while would be good, move it to the next plant and so on. Whatever works best for you. But the timing of that for me on my property is, I like to get that kind of deep soaking done before the heat, right before the heat happens, so we can get through that three-day heat event, just checking on newly planted plants, things in containers, not having to run irrigation during extremely high temperatures. The plants have what they need ahead of time.
So when you say extended forecast, extended from what? In other words, is it like 3 days they're pretty sure and then they have extended, or is it 5 days and then they have extended? What's the extended from?
They can go out to 7 to 10 days. And if you go to models like Ventesky, you can see exactly what they're looking at, the movement of great big masses of air down from the north, in from the ocean and so forth. And the pattern they're expected to take, they run these through multiple replications and they look at the average of those. And the different models that are from different university consortiums and organizations sometimes come up with different solutions. And when that happens, sometimes they blend them and average them, and sometimes they just put them in front of you. And right now, if you go to Ventesky, which is a fun thing to look at if you're really into weather, shows the airflow, it shows the temperatures, you can drag your cursor around, and you go to one model and you just take it and drag it up what would be Interstate 80. The map is right there. They show Vacaville, they show Sacramento and so forth. And you can watch the temperature, of course, increase as you go inland, which is what you'd expect. And it can be very dramatic. And you can look at one model and then you can shift over to another model. And the two models they're showing right now have an 8-degree different outcome with respect to Sacramento as you go 7 to 10 days out. Obviously, that far out is less precise. They're making a bunch of guesses, a bunch of educated and well-educated guesses, but in some cases they're just they're obviously just projections. You can compare the models. You can then look at the biggest impact, which I think is really important for local gardeners. Go to Vacaville, then go towards Sacramento. Right now, there's a 10-degree difference on one of those hot days further out several days between Vacaville and Sacramento for the same time of day. So that's telling us that they are expecting on that model for the delta influence to predominate. For those of us closer to the coast, it's going to be much more comfortable than the further in. And of course, the further up the valley you go, Redding, famous for the high temperatures, Red Bluff, Chico, all the areas up in the state on Highway 5, if you're familiar with driving north on I-5, all those cities you go through, Corning, so forth, are going to be obviously much hotter. They don't get the delta influence. So, some of that is just obviously terrain, geography, but some of it is how strong is the ridge, how quickly is it expected to break down, and then the delta influence pushes back in. If you get out your Sunset Western Garden book, and if you don't have one, you should go out and buy one at a used bookstore at this point. It's the only way you're going to find one, most likely. and look closely at the maps of the Sunset Western Garden Book climate zones. And you'll understand, looking at the geography and the overlay of the zones, that that's really what those zones are all about. The impact of terrain, of topography, of geography on the way the air moves in off the ocean and how it goes north or south and the influence of the delta. And we are at the mouth of the delta, really. We're just up from the mouth of the delta in Dixon, Davis, Woodland. So we are much more strongly affected by the coastal breeze, the delta breeze, than people are just 10, 15 miles further in Sacramento. Davis is zone 14. Dixon is zone 14. Woodland is zone 8. Sacramento is zone 9 by the Sunset Western Garden Book zones. And what that reflects is where they are with respect to the delta breeze and that coastal influence. Every now and then, we'll get a huge high pressure dome, kind of thing that happens where it's centered over the Four Corners region, way down there, New Mexico, Arizona, and expands out. And sometimes that dome goes all the way over all of us, even San Francisco, you know, even coastal cities like San Francisco. I've been there when it's 100 degrees during one of those events. Let me tell you, the folks who live there don't know how to deal with that. It's very uncommon. More typically, the extent of that kind of dome is into the valley, Fresno, Barstow, Bakersfield, up to where we are, Sacramento, east side of the valley, but it doesn't always completely affect us. We get more influence from the delta, which is one of the nice things about living on this side of the Sacramento Valley. So that's what makes a difference in the Sunset Western Garden Book zones, which people are using less and less, unfortunately, as time goes by, because there's, you know, no new edition of Sunset coming out. USDA zones don't reflect that at all. USDA zones just reflect the colder, you know, how cold you get in the winter, basically. So one useful thing about the Sunset Western zones is that they do show these differences that we're going to be seeing in the next 7 to 10 days, as we may, very likely, will have stronger coastal influence than people just 15 or 20 miles further inland. And I know many of you listening are further inland. So you may get to 107. We might only get to 101. Come on over to Davis and say hi. So I want to mention a couple of you contacted us. There was a problem with the podcast from June 13th, and I really appreciate you bringing it to our attention, because 5 minutes of that show got completely garbled. With the specificity of what you told me, folks, I was able to go in and find it, isolate the problem, figure out how my software had been screwing up, and fix it. KDRT is community radio, which means we're public radio, which means we rely on contributions from folks like you to keep our shows on the air. So if you like what you hear, if you like the Davis Garden Show, That's Life, Jazz After Dark, or the 29 other shows I believe there are at this point that are produced locally, head on over to kdrt.org and click on the support button. And while you're over there, you can read about the other great programming here at KDRT. And there is an extraordinarily eclectic range of programming. One of my favorite shows, curiously, is Praise Time with Preacher. Preacher is his name. It's not a title. He's a very, very nice guy, and he's very enthusiastic about gospel music. And he believes it's powerful whether or not you're religious, because everyone can enjoy the uplifting, inspiring sound. It's sung with passion and belief from the artist and touches all who hear it in a good and heartfelt way. So the aim of Praise Time with Preacher is to help listeners find what Preacher believes lives in everyone, a good spirit that drives us to be the best we can be. Praise Time with Preacher is live Tuesdays from 4 to 5 p.m., and it replays Sunday morning, 7 to 8 a.m. Praise Time with Preacher. You can find that and all the other programming on the schedule guide at kdrt.org. I like to mention the events of the UC Davis Bohart Museum of Entomology, and they do continue through the summer. Saturday, July 20th, it's Moth Night at the museum. Moth Night. And, you know, it doesn't give me any detail about what happens on Moth Night, 7 to 11 p.m., Saturday, July 20th. So I suggest you just check it out at Bohart, that's B-O-H-A-R-T, .ucdavis.edu. I'm going to go out on a limb and assume you look at a bunch of moths. I don't know if they're dead or alive, but moths are fascinating. And you can be there for 4 hours, Saturday, July 20th, Moth Night at the museum.
Ken, who was on the show a little while ago and we answered his question, has written again. So let me read that. And we have photos too. Ken is from Palo Alto. Thank you so much for answering my lawn question last week. I'm gearing up to reseed my lawn this fall. Unfortunately, I'm still using a 38-year-old electric Honda lawnmower, and the height of the lawn is set at the maximum height. And it's still super short. I'm thinking about getting a new lawnmower. However, how can one tell what the lawnmower will cut at the highest height? We'll answer this and then come back to the rest of his question.
Yeah, I'm not an expert on that kind of power equipment, but I would go to a store that specializes in it rather than buying your lawnmower at a, let's say, big box emporium where you're just buying it off the shelf and talking to a 20-year-old. Nothing against
And JB's is a lawnmower repair place, and they also know everything about.
Yeah, but that'd be a long drive for Ken. That's in Davis, but sure, I'll throw in a plug for JB's.
Call them up.
Who opened shortly before we did in 1980. I think they opened it in 79, something like that. Been around for a long time. You surely in Palo Alto have a power equipment emporium, bearing in mind that, of course, in California, you can only buy electric power mowers at this point. That's a very good question. If you can get it set at 3 inches, great. If you can't, and I've run into this, I was just talking to someone about this problem earlier, whose lawn had thinned out really badly because they mowed it right before extremely high temperatures, and they mowed it what the mower was set at, which they didn't seem to be able to adjust. And that's commonly the case, unfortunately. In that case, just don't mow going into hot weather. The problem is that most people either mow their lawn on a regular schedule because of their own personal work schedules, or they pay someone to mow their lawn on a regular schedule that doesn't relate to the weather. Mm-hmm. And if it's about to get hot or windy, probably less of an issue in Palo Alto than it is here in the Valley, but pretty much anywhere. If it's about to be a hot spell, a windy spell, hold off on mowing a couple of days if you possibly can. Our pattern in California is high temperatures 2 to 3 days, dropping down to cooler temperatures for 4 to 5 days. You know, that's the cycle we go through, certainly here in the Sacramento Valley, especially when we're closer to the coast, as we talked about earlier. So if you can hold off a couple of days and not mow when it's about to get higher than average temperatures, or when you're about to have a dry north wind. Southern Californians mowing right before a Santa Ana wind could be very harmful to what we call cool season grasses. Won't hurt your Bermuda grass, but not great for your ryegrass, fescue, things like that. If you can hold off, so much the better. Old rule of thumb is try not to mow off more than a third of the leaf blade at any time. So going too long can stress the lawn as well. But just delaying a couple of days, if you possibly can do that, is one way you can prevent your lawn from thinning out abruptly, the most common outcome when you mow it short during hot weather or very dry, windy weather. If you can set your mower to 2.5-3 inches, so much the better. And as you're buying a new one, that would be a key question as to whether you can. I'll try to do a little research and find out models where you can do that, because I don't know the new electric models really at all. And so maybe I'll send a note over to our friends there at JB's and see what we can find out in terms of ability to adjust the mowing height. If you can't adjust the height, adjust your schedule. So next question.
I'm wondering, though, if he's got this old mower and you're going to replace it, you could try get somebody at that mower shop to look at it and see if you can simply increase the size of the wheels. Now, that won't work if the wheels are under something, but if the wheels are out in the open, maybe you could just make the wheels an inch or two bigger, and that would make your lawnmower higher.
I'm impressed that he's using a 38-year-old electric lawnmower.
I'm impressed that he knows how old it is.
38-year-old lawnmower. That's darn good. That's a good run. So anyway, yeah. Next question.
Okay, so he's the rest of the email from Ken says, I have another problem that I need your help with. My azalea plants are gradually turning brown. This includes a 20-year-old azalea and one smaller newly planted one last year. The small one started turning brown about 3 months ago. They are watered about twice a week. Any idea what's going on? I fertilize with an organic EB Stone General fertilizer along with alfalfa pellets. Should mention that these are under a magnolia tree. And then he sent very good pictures, and pictures of the plants and then pictures of the area. And so, Don, what did you see in those pictures?
Well, first of all, the plants around these azaleas look healthy. So the first question I have when people send me pictures is I'm trying to just evaluate for drought stress. For a plant like azalea, if it is drought stressed, you will see leaves browning, leaves dropping, and that's a fairly common reaction. But the other plants in the landscape don't appear to be too unusually colored or showing any stress, except in the third picture where there's a Fatsia japonica. For those of you who know it by the common name, that's Japanese Aralia, the big bold leaf thing that looks kind of tropical. And it appears a little yellow or green than normal, as if it's a little sunburned, as if it was a little under irrigated at some point. I've got to say, though, the other plants in the landscape don't appear to be showing significant stress. We do encounter this kind of disparity in the landscape when people are using drip or micro spray systems and they're not distributing the water evenly. And everything goes fine in the spring, and then we hit our first drier, windy spell, and that poor distribution means that some of the roots of the plant are not getting irrigated and the plant shows stress. And the first thing an azalea does when it gets stressed is it tends to brown and drop leaves. So that's the first question I have, is how long? Twice a week is probably fine. It depends on your soil, obviously, but I don't know how many gallons you're giving to each plant. It needs at least a couple, if not a few gallons, with each irrigation. I will say, in our area, azaleas are particularly susceptible, unfortunately, to Phytophthora crown rot, crown and root rot. And so, will they need water? So this is the flip side. You know, drought can be one factor. Unfortunately, the exact same symptoms can arise from crown and root rot, Phytophthora, from watering too frequently or keeping it too wet, especially right around the crown of the plant. So the very first thing I would do is get down there and pull away all the duff and leaf debris and stuff that's around the plants and see if there's moisture there. If there's moisture, then it means you're not under irrigating, but you could be watering too often. You could be keeping it too wet right next to the crown of the plant. I also should mention, this is one of those little things you never learn about, the nursery industry has a big problem with azaleas. There are root diseases that we get in container production in the nursery industry that are just chronic, and they are very, very hard to deal with. Way back when I was a student and learning about nursery production, there were fungicidal drenches that could be used that would cure those problems. As time went by, for a variety of very good reasons, those different fungicides went off the market, and new ones came along. There were kind of new generation fungicides that suppressed the disease problems. The plant would grow, but you're not eradicating the pathogen. And so that's fine. The healthy plant goes out to the customer's yard and everything is fine if it gets watered correctly and there's no stress and so on. But if there is stress, all of a sudden the disease, which is present, would attack again. And I believe it's a fusarium disease in the case of azaleas. I didn't do any research prior, but that's my recollection from years ago. So it's quite possible, regrettably, that the plants you installed had this disease and got stressed, and then they got attacked by the disease. It came with the plant in some cases. More commonly, we see camellias and azaleas, which need even moisture. You know, they're not tolerant of drought, but they can also get overwatered because they're vulnerable to Phytophthora. So that perfect balance of watering enough but not too much can be a challenge with them, with camellias, but especially with azaleas. And it's more of a problem here in the valley because they get subjected to heat stress on top of all that. But if you happen to have a hot spell and you happen to not be distributing the water real well, or it is a little too often and it got trapped, moisture got trapped around the crown, all of those could be at play here. And determining between drought and crown rot, they're the same symptoms, regrettably. So you go to one nursery, they're going to say, well, you're obviously overwatering. You go to another nursery, they're going to say, well, you're clearly not watering enough. And you'll walk out of there going, I am being told conflicting things. What I will tell you is water really thoroughly when you do. Go as long as you can between waterings without stressing the plant. So running it longer might help, making sure it's distributing well would be the key thing right there. So getting in there and checking the micro sprayers or the drippers or whatever you're watering with, then figure out how long you're running it. And that plant needs to be watered to a depth of about 18 inches, which is going to take at least a few gallons of water. So you can do the math with your drippers, or you can measure it with your micro sprayers and see, you know, exactly how much you're putting out. And you can measure that and send us the information. We can talk about it. Because while I try to discuss these things with customers in numbers of gallons or numbers of inches, that isn't what they're really looking for. What they're looking for is, how long should I run it? How often? Well, we need that basic information to answer that. But I want you to get a deeper watering when you can and try not to keep it constantly damp around the base of the azalea because of their vulnerability to those particular crown and root rot organisms.
Well, I'm looking at the first picture.
Yeah.
And I see a sprinkler head at the base of that picture. So I'm assuming that that sprinkler is watering those plants.
Probably. Yeah.
One way to tell whether or not you've got enough water or not is take your 18-inch screwdriver,
yep.
Go down between the two plants and stick that sucker in the ground. Yeah. Now it should go in if the soil is moist enough.
Yeah, it'll pass easily into soil that's moist, and then you'll get resistance as you get to drier soil. And so that tells you the depth you've irrigated. And very commonly, people who've been irrigating what they think is fine, and the plants basically look fine until our first hot spell, our first heat wave or something like that, we'll find they're actually only irrigating to a depth of 6 to 12 inches, which you can keep a plant alive with that, but it would be better if you could water deeper and wider so the roots can get down and out. People often don't realize how extensive the root system of even a small shrub would be if it could be. But if it isn't irrigated, they can't grow, roots can't grow into dry soil. So check the distribution, figure out your duration, and do pull away the stuff. And this is the tricky part, because as we get older, these positions are uncomfortable. But get down there, crawl down under there, pull the mulch away, and look closely, if you can, at the stem, the trunk of the little azalea. And if it looks kind of damp, if the bark seems like it's a little loose, you may well have crown rot. The other thing to know about the pathogen Phytophthora that attacks the crown is it also can attack just roots, not necessarily on the crown. So if you pulled one out, although this obviously amounts to an autopsy at that point, if you pull one out and the roots are kind of slippery, in other words, the bark just slipped right off, then they probably were attacked by a Phytophthora cinnamomae or perhaps another pathogen. More commonly, what you see is crown rot. So that's why we usually use that term. But it is true that it can also attack just the roots and not necessarily show any symptoms right on the crown of the plant. Gets a little confusing because I've just told you might be overwatering, you might be underwatering, you're probably not watering enough. Maybe you don't need to water quite so often, but look for that those symptoms on the base of the plant, and that'd be the first thing I would do. Getting airflow around a plant can actually solve the problem. If it's Phytophthora, if you change the conditions of constantly damp around the stem, it can arrest the disease. And we've seen even well-established trees grow out of, they're still infected, but it's no longer spreading, and they can grow out of it essentially. So it is possible to save the plant depending on how far it's gone, if that happens to be the problem.
You mentioned that the little plant might have come with something from the nursery when it was brought home.
Good chance, yep.
So the other plant is a 20-year-old azalea.
Yeah.
Been there 20 years. Now, if I have this plant, it looks like it's about 4 feet away.
Yeah.
Is the stuff that's in the, if there were stuff in the new pot that was harmful, would it crawl over 4 feet to the old plant?
Well, crawl is not connected. Crawl is actually kind of a funny term. If it's Phytophthora, it has motile spores, which is why Phytophthora is no longer considered a fungus. It's been moved over to a different kingdom in the world of biology. It can swim over. There aren't very many fungus, any true fungus that swim, but the spores of Phytophthora do. So if you have saturated soil conditions and they persist long enough under high temperature conditions, it literally can swim from plant to plant. If it's a fusarium disease that was in the plant you purchased, yes, it can, by root contact, move from plant to plant. So to answer your question, yes, it can get from one to the other, unfortunately. If it's Phytophthora, we talk about Phytophthora so much because it is one of the major landscape problems people have. It doesn't necessarily attack the next plant you put in. Change the conditions that would favor infection by adjusting your irrigation frequency and, to a simple extent, elevating the plant. When you turn a bunch of compost in at the time of planting, that's bad because it means everything sinks. You end up with a low spot. And then with a low spot, leaf debris starts to collect and you have moisture trapped around the crown. But if you add some kind of, I don't really push this, but you will see this recommendation. It does work to an extent. If you add some kind of mineral component, pumice, something like that, to just get air in the soil that's right around the plant, that can reduce it considerably. We don't recommend sand. That's one of the first things people think of, because sand interlocking with clay or silt makes it form
concrete.
Literally, but it acts like it. It greatly reduces the infiltration rate of the soil when you do that. So you have a problem with water penetrating. But if it's a big chunky thing like lava rock or pumice, which is a form of lava rock, then you're actually just making it more porous right around the area where you would be likelier to have the point of infection. So that can work to a degree. The main thing I think it really does is that people turn it in and they inadvertently create a high spot. and then they plant on the high spot. So even if it settles over time, it's still above grade. That's the key. So water always percolates away, and plants that are sensitive to Phytophthora and other crown and root attacking organisms, that can be all it takes, whether it's Daphne or an azalea or something where the comment in the trade is not be careful not to overwater, which is, of course, a misused term. But the main thing is not to have moisture trapped around the crown of the plant. Well, if you elevate it with something that's got air trapped in it, like pumice, that can do that. That can actually take care of that. So that's worth a try. But the main thing is to adjust your current irrigation and also get down there and check and see if you see any symptoms on the stem. You know, you're going to need to take your phone and use the flashlight part or something like that to look closer. You'll see what looks like a water-soaked area on the stem. You might even see some brown oozing or staining. It might appear to be progressing up the stem. It's really easy to see on trees because you got a trunk. On the case of an azalea, maybe a little harder to see what you're after, but it's worth a look. Just try and see if you can see something down there.
Earlier, you had talked about something, and you said the size was a 50-cent piece. Now, I know what a quarter looks like. I know what a coined dollar looks like. They're very rare, but I've seen them. What the heck is a 50-cent piece?
Okay. Yeah, you're right. I'm showing my age. They're still out there. You can get them. All right. The size of a dollar coin. No, they're smaller. 50-cent pieces were bigger.
Oh, really?
Haven't you seen a 50-cent piece?
Not that I know. Not that I remember. Of course, I'm old. I might have forgotten.
2-inch diameter, I guess, roughly. Yes. Okay. I can wonder how many people out there are going, 50-cent piece? Do we have those?
How many people out there are going, 2 inches? What's that?
How many centimeters is it? Yeah. All right.
All right. So back to the mailbag. We have John in Fair Oaks. Now, Fair Oaks is near Davis, isn't it?
Fair Oaks is on
the foothills a little bit. Fair
Oaks is on the other side of Sacramento. It's technically in Zone 9, I think, on the Sunset basis. So my business partner many years ago, when we opened the nursery, I started with a gentleman who retired many, many years ago. He lived in Fair Oaks, and we would often swap notes about the weather differences between east side of Sacramento and Davis. He would go out to his car to drive over, and it would be breezy over there, and he'd hit the Yolo Causeway, and the north wind would be howling. So we are definitely windier here, but we also get the strong coastal or delta influence more than they do there, or sooner than they do there. Let's put it that way. So it'll cool off here 7 in the evening, maybe not there until 9. That's the kind of difference that you see from being further in the interior. However, his question was about a grass. So
is Fair Oaks up in an elevation, or is that as Sacramento? Okay. It's the same as that. Yep. So hi, Don and Lois. Two of my three Carl Forster feather reed grasses have not sent up any seed plumes this year. And this is the third year and the third one has only a few. All three are in the same area, receive the same treatment, and have plenty of foliage. What could this be? Should I have been dividing these grasses every few years? And if so, is it too late to do it now?
No, well, this isn't, I wouldn't divide them in June or July. I would do it in the fall or the early spring would be better choices in the middle of the summer. As to why they're not blooming, the most common reasons would boil down to excessive nitrogen or increasing shade. Those are the two most typical reasons that you would see. You get vigorous growth when you feed them with some source of nitrogen, and that could be at the expense of bloom production. If trees nearby are beginning to cast shade over them, then they won't bloom as well. Could just be weather. It's the easiest thing to look at first. Have we had long periods of cool weather? Yes, we have. So that might be part of it. So I would look at weather phenomena as the most likely, possibly increasing shade. If you happen to inadvertently dump a bunch of nitrogen on them, you could get lush growth at the expense of bloom. Those are the most common reasons I can think of. I don't think it has to do with dividing them. That's an easy enough thing to do and a great way to increase them. But I don't think that's why they're not blooming.
There, it sounds like they're in the ground, not in a pot.
Right. That actually brings us to an important question about root zone distribution of shrubs. So there was a question about gardenia. Did you find that question?
No.
Okay, let me see if I can find it because I've got it right.
Maybe you didn't forward it to me.
That is possible, yes.
The question sometimes.
Let's see here. It was about what size container.
I got it.
There you go. Go ahead.
How big a pot does a gardenia need to have? What does it need to do well here? She asked jokingly, can I grow a gardenia as a bonsai?
Well,
the answer to the last one is yeah.
Yeah, sure. You can grow anything as a bonsai. I've seen some fascinating plants that the bonsai experts have done well with. Anytime you plant a woody plant in a container, in effect, if you're going to keep it in that container, you are doing that. You're intentionally or unintentionally stunting it, dwarfing it by putting it in something that constrains the roots. A shrub in a container, a shrub the size of a gardenia, with one exception, needs to be in something the size of an oak barrel, a half barrel. That's a 3 cubic foot soil volume. Actually, it's closer to 4 cubic foot, 3 to 3.5 cubic foot soil volume is what you're going to need because it's a shrub. I've had people wanting to grow rose bushes in containers. Well, that's fine with a few exceptions. Almost all of them need a half barrel or something bigger would be even better. So, you know, if you see a 3x3 shrub, its roots, if you could excavate them and lay them out, would be as much as 5 feet deep and out in many cases, some cases deeper and wider. Roots go out where they can. And if they can't, obviously, you have to provide everything the plant needs at that point, all the water and all the nutrients. So I manage lots of things in containers. I've spent my whole career managing things in containers. You can manage a plant in a container for decades. Bonsai, they're hundreds of years old, and they're given exactly what they need in terms of water, and the fertilizer is applied in a way that's appropriate to that plant, and the fact that they're keeping it very dwarf and so forth. You can do all that, but I'm assuming you want optimum growth and maximum bloom. So you generally need at least a 15-gallon bucket for 2 to 3 years, and a half barrel would hold it for several years. And even in that, with the soils you're going to use, you'll probably find yourself watering, not necessarily daily, but pretty darn close to daily in the summer here in the Sacramento Valley, especially after the first year in that container. The roots will fill it very quickly. It'll be technically root bound. You're going to be managing an enclosed root system, and you're going to be providing everything that it needs. And so whether it's a tomato plant or the cannabis you've decided to grow, or a gardenia or a rose bush or a Japanese maple, it's just a matter of how quickly it's going to get root bound and when you're going to have to start providing more frequent irrigation, more frequent nutrient application. Fertilizer is what I mean by that. So a gardenia is fine in a barrel. You can do it in a smaller pot for a year, you know, 2 years, maybe, if it's something as big as a 15 gallon. There is one exception to all of what I just said. It's the little dwarf variety called radicans. It's a little miniature gardenia, which would be great for bonsai, by the way. Grows about 1 to 2 feet by 2 to 3 feet and very small leaf, very commonly variegated. The variegation is not stable, so it happens. And then sometimes it's not there. Sometimes you get green shoots on it, but it's just kind of a cool feature. It has perfect little 50-cent piece size flowers that are just as fragrant as the other gardenias. And so if you are limited for space, if you want something with that fragrance and you don't have a place in the ground for a shrub or a bigger container that you can manage, look for the dwarf one. Radicans is the name. Gardenia jasminoides radicans is the name you're going to find on the label. It's obviously much more compact right there in the container. And it blooms like crazy. That's really cool. So if you like gardenias, that's one option. But if you want the regular old-fashioned 2 to 3 inch flowers, or the big ones like mystery with the 3 to 4 inch flowers, you're looking at a shrub that wants to get anywhere from 3 to 5 feet tall and wide, and obviously would have roots bigger than that if they possibly can. So the bigger the container, the better here in the Sacramento Valley. Having said all of that, those of you listening in coastal climates know full well, you can grow things in containers a lot more easily than we can. I mean, my mother, even well into her elderly years, had many containers around her patio. Although she focused heavily on succulents, she had a lot of other things as well. She had, according to the very detailed list on her refrigerator door with her watering schedule, 82 container plants around the patio and backyard that she watered once a week. That wouldn't work in the Sacramento Valley. That's because she was in coastal, overcast San Diego. And so if you missed a day, you could go water the next day. The plant wouldn't be dead. Here in the Valley, you miss a day, you're going to go down to the nursery and buy another plant. So wherever you're listening, what I just said may be a little less applicable if you're in a milder climate that is predominantly in, let's say, the 65 to 80 degree range. You can go several days between watering containers. Here, it's pretty much a daily thing. Even bigger containers may need it every couple of days. So if you have a lot of containers, you typically embark on a drip system or something to water them automatically, which isn't perfect, but it makes your life easier. But the bigger the container, the better in terms of long-term management of woody plants, and be prepared to provide not just all the water that it needs, but periodically providing nutrients by whatever method is most convenient for you. So we're just about to July, and there are some interesting things on the July calendar page. July is a time here where it's still a lot of things from spring blooming, but they're beginning to fray and look a little rough. And it's been really hot at least a few times. And there are plants that can take that heat. People who move here to the Davis, Sacramento Valley area from other parts of the country are often surprised we can be doing anything out in our gardens in the summer. They think it's, you know, 110 every day and everything stops blooming. It must be awful. No, there's things that love that kind of heat. There are things that thrive on desert heat, and we plan for that. If you have that page open in front of you, there's a couple things on there that just are real heat lovers.
I actually don't have it open in front of me.
All right, I do. So the one that I'm looking at, the reason I thought of this is celosia.
Oh, that's celosia. A pretty one. Yeah.
Most people know the coxcomb, which is the crested version of it. The plume flower types are very pretty as well. They don't even go in the ground until mid-May. I mean, that's the kind of thing. They're like zinnias. They want warm soil. They're one of the things you plant with your when you're planting your peppers and your eggplant, and the soil has hit, let's hope, for 70 degrees, and they will thrive on that. And if you buy them at the nursery and put them in the ground, they'll just take right away. They are bright, hot colors and incredibly easy to grow in full summer sun in the Sacramento Valley. I know that seems amazing to some people. The other one that's on there is lantana. And boy, have they become popular with bedding plant growers in the last couple of years. Lantana loves heat. It thrives in the valley. It is invasive in some parts of the world, but not in California, thank goodness. And there's a whole bunch of new ones that have come on the market. So I do need to explain this difference. Lantana that we grew up with are big, sprawling plants.
It's a bush.
It's more than that. Yeah, it was a 5 foot tall by 8 feet across. If you want to see examples, you happen to be coming down by my nursery. The building next door, which is Davis Media Access, where this is broadcasting from, there's the old-fashioned variety. Radiation is the name of lantana right in front there. It fills the entire front bed. They whack it back hard every so often, comes right back and blooms again. And it's about 5 to 6 feet tall and would go 7 or 8 feet across if it possibly could. That's what we grew up with. That was the most common form of lantana, the Chimera hybrids back in the 60s and 70s. They became incredibly popular in California. Butterflies love them. Hummingbirds visit them. Really easy to grow. Prune them if you want. Don't prune them if you don't want, and so forth. But a little frost tender thing to know about lantana is, well, it recovers every winter. It almost always, these hybrids almost always freeze back to some degree. So the foliage can look rough. We were just having a conversation at our garden center. Do we call them deciduous or not? Because functionally they are. In other words, you can expect the foliage to be so badly damaged by winter cold that they look deciduous. Technically, they're evergreen subtropicals that get their foliage damaged by the cold. So they function as if they were deciduous. They don't have a normal cycle of being deciduous. They just get cold injury. The purple ground cover form, which has become very popular, only gets a foot or two tall and spreads several feet. And it is much more cold hardy. That plant even blooms through the winter in protected locations. Some of those in front of the building next door as well. Frequently blooming in December and January, looking just fine. Just whack them back every now and then and they'll come back just fine. But if you don't have room for a 6 or 7 foot spreading plant, the breeders of lantana have crossed the Chimera hybrids with some other species and come out with some very dwarf lantanas. The bedding plant industry thinks this is great. You get something that blooms in a quart pot that you can sell anywhere in the country, it suddenly becomes a summer annual in most of the rest of the United States. You can go into garden centers in the Mid-Atlantic and upper Midwest and even New England and find lantanas being sold for summer bloom. So now they're being sold, and this is confusing people, essentially as a summer annual anywhere outside of USDA Zone 9. And we know that these are perennials. But the important thing to know about these new ones with names like Lucky Pot of Gold, you know, some of these, they're dwarf. They only get about 2 by 3. Right? By the end of the summer, they'll be a little bush, and that's it. And they do freeze back somewhat. You cut them back, they do come back for us. They're perennial for us. They go through the same pattern as the big ones, but they never get more than about, let's say, 3 by 3. Really handy if you're looking for something for a small garden. They never stop blooming until finally freezing weather comes along. Attract all kinds of beneficials, particularly butterflies, especially the skippers and the little blues, the ones that kids like to try and catch. So lantanas are great for that. But bear in mind, they're not going to get as big as you might be expecting if you grew up with the old-fashioned types of lantana. They're also great for containers. So if you're looking for a flowering thing for full sun in the summer in the valley, and you have a container that's, let's say, at least 12 to 14 inch diameter, a single lantana in that will do very well. So it's a good group of plants. Just bear in mind, there is some toxicity. So if you've got young kids, be aware of the possible, you know, ingestion of them. Other than that, lantana is pretty tough and indestructible. And now we have versions that are great for smaller gardens as well.
Well, we have some questions that have walked into the store, down store. Well, okay. Actually, people walked in. The questions came with the people.
Questions follow them, yes.
Yes. So this is from earlier. Two people came in one morning asking about what to do about powdery mildew on crepe myrtle.
Yeah, and that same thing just the other day, someone came in with mildew on a London plane tree, which we all call sycamores out here. We get late season rain in California, especially late April, early May. We're just going to have another round of mildew on the newly emerged leaves of crepe myrtles. That's one particular type of powdery mildew. London plane trees or sycamore trees, another type of mildew. They tend to be host specific. Even on your roses, you might have powdery mildew after that kind of weather. There are completely mildew resistant varieties and have been for 50 years. Yeah. So if anyone sold you a crepe myrtle within the last 50 years that gets mildew, it's their fault. You should be looking for the ones that are resistant. That's really what should be in the trade. It always frustrates me when I see wholesalers and retailers that still have the old varieties of crepe myrtles. And, you know, it doesn't hurt the plant all that much. It's just unsightly. And that's true of mildew in general. So if you really have a chronic problem with it on a crepe myrtle, I know this is a sort of a extreme suggestion, but take out that crepe myrtle and put one in that's resistant. In the case of the sycamore or the London plane tree, they are just fine. They'll grow out of it. If you're looking to plant one, look for the mildew-resistant clones or cultivar. They also, in the case of Columbia, is resistant to anthracnose blight, which is another thing that hits London plane trees if we get rain as the leaves are emerging, which happened this year. So we get a lot of leaf drop from the anthracnose, and we get some leaf drop from the powdery mildew. If you have an old-fashioned London plane tree or an old-fashioned, like our native sycamore, you're sure to get those diseases in a wet spring. There's nothing to be done about them, but a tree with good vigor will outgrow them with no problem. So it's nothing, you can't do anything about it, but you don't need to worry about it, is really what it comes down to with those. If you're choosing a London plane tree, look for the resistant varieties and you'll have a healthier looking tree, even in the years when we have late season rainfall. Mildew does actually, interestingly, wash off the leaf. It's most fungus, we're not going to say wash off the plant because it has a disease. Seems like that would increase the problem. But in the case of mildew on roses, it's long been understood that it is not well attached. You can rub it right off the leaf. You can also wash it right off the leaf. And we're so dry here in the afternoon and into the early evening that if you go out almost any time of day, even into the mid-afternoon, and do this vigorous rinsing that we always suggest for managing aphids and whiteflies and other pest problems, you'll actually reduce your mildew quite a bit. Also, with roses, as with all these others, there are susceptible varieties and there are resistant varieties. So if a rose is chronically getting mildew in your garden, prune it with a shovel and plant one that's resistant or just put up with it. It doesn't really hurt the plant all that much. It's mostly a cosmetic thing. But with crepe myrtles, it's just a frustration to me that anybody is still selling the susceptible varieties because it really is unnecessary. There's the same color range, the same size range available in crepe myrtles for the resistant types as there was for the older types. So you want a tree, there are tree forms. You want a bush, there's bush forms. There's even dwarf types. And there are ones that are quite resistant to powdery mildew. So just look for those if you happen to be shopping for a crepe myrtle. Now, there's another plant that's very common in landscapes in California that gets mildew, but it also gets an insect that looks like mildew. And that's euonymus.
What's euonymus?
Euonymus japonica. There's a bunch of different forms of euonymus. East Coast listeners know the burning bush, euonymus alata, which may or may not get these problems. I don't know. And then there's the ground cover form of euonymus called euonymus fortunii. But here in California, one of the most common landscape shrubs for many, many years, brought into California by Japanese nurserymen back in the early 1900s, became an absolute staple of landscapes in older urban areas. So if you're going through William Land Park in Sacramento, places like that, it was one of the most common shiny leafed evergreen shrubs that would be planted near a cottage or as a hedge. And there's a golden variegated one that became unbelievably popular and a white variegated one that became very popular. Both of those, just a side note, have a tendency to send out branches that aren't variegated. So you get green parts and variegated on the same shrub, and the green parts can slowly overtake the shrub, which bothers some people. Others think it's kind of cool. They have two different colors on the same plant. That's euonymus japonica, Japanese euonymus. And it was very, very, very heavily planted in California. And as often happens, a pest specific to euonymus, two pests specific to euonymus showed up. A particular powdery mildew that is very intractable. You get it on there, it doesn't really rub off. It's really sort of stuck on the leaf. And it's just going to get worse and worse, especially if the euonymus happens to be in increasing shade, which is very common because, as I say, these are often shrubs in older neighborhoods where trees are growing up and providing a canopy of shade. So that's going to be a problem. You can prune it out. You can try and wash it off. There's not really, you know, who's going to go out and spray their hedge with a fungicide? Probably not something that really needs to be happening. But the other thing they get is a particular type of scale. And the scale, I often have to show people that it's an actual insect. The leaf is, by the time they bring it in, I've had three cases now in the last 2 weeks where people have walked in, what is this disease? And I say, okay, watch. And I take my thumbnail, I just push them off and I show them the little scale on my thumbnail. Their little tiny narrow scale. And there's so many of them, it looks like white mold is growing on the leaf, but it's actually an insect. This is one of the few scale insects that multiplies very rapidly and can actually kill the plant. Most scale stress the plant. They can get pretty bad. You see all the sticky stuff underneath them, or you'll see ants visiting them, protecting them. They like the sticky stuff that the scale are excreting. Those are the scale you get on your trees and shrubs. And, you know, they're pretty manageable. You can just prune out a little bit here and there, wash them off. Natural predators, birds will actually eat a lot of scale insects. This one, I do not see natural predators feeding on them, and it will actually kill whole branches. So by the time people notice it, it looks like the plant is covered with what they think is mildew, and branches are beginning to die. Good news, it seems to be completely host specific to euonymus. So that's positive. It's not going to go from your euonymus onto your pittosporum nearby. Bad news is it's really, really hard to control. And in my recommendation typically is this is going to be an annual problem for you. You can prune it out. You can go after it with a pressure washer. You can try spraying oil sprays, but honestly, I don't think they're going to work real well. Or you can say, it's time for a new shrub. Okay. Once again, changing from the euonymus to something totally unrelated that is not a host for that particular pest is your best long-term answer. Last person I talked with, he had a whole hedge of this euonymus. And so it's okay. Well, that's a big conversation. So I would just start by pruning it out. He had a pressure washer. That sounded like fun. Prune it out. Take your pressure washer. Clean the plant off really thoroughly. Monitor. Now that you know it's an insect, not a disease, now that you know that physically removing it with a pressure washer can actually work up to a point, you can hold it at bay that way, and you can keep your hedge looking okay that way as you decide whether you're going to take the whole thing out and bite the bullet and just do a whole new hedge, or you're going to start whittling at the ends of it. You know, take down the three at the end or the most infested ones and replace those with something. And now you've broken up your hedge, so it's a little more informal looking. And are you ready to bite the bullet and go to the Davis Garden Show recommendation of a mixed hedge instead of a solid hedge of one species? And you have so many opportunities now. You have all these flowering shrubs and things you can do, but that takes more time and effort and planning. So for starters, yeah, prune it out. That actually works up to a point. Vigorously rinse it off. I don't think an insecticide is necessary in most cases, especially if your long-term plan is to replace the plant with something that is not a host for euonymus scale. So the mildew, manageable up to a point. The scale tends to just get worse and worse. It was time to think about a replacement, but it doesn't have to be all at once. I could see his facial expression, and I finally realized he had 40 feet of euonymus. Mm. Okay, that's a big thing. You know, that if it were mine, I would take out maybe the three in the middle, put a tree there, put some nice shrubs around it. That starts the process. Now your spouse is not angry because you have something pretty there instead of a gap. Then you realize you have an opportunity to take out the ones closer to the house and put in something lovely there. I don't know, some roses or something. So you can change over your landscape to get the benefits of a hedge without the hassle of this host-specific pest problem.
Or you could do what Lois would probably do. Take out every other one and plant a xylosma instead. Yeah.
Well, every other one is one option. Or you know what? Take a chainsaw, cut the whole thing to the ground, haul it all away, let it re-sprout. It'll probably go 3 or 4 years before the scale catches up with you again. You can manage this in any of a number of ways. But in the old days, nurseries would try and have you embark on an eradication strategy. We're going to kill every single scale there. We're going to spray alternating malathion and summer oils and whatnot. One, people don't do that anymore. Two, it isn't effective. And particularly the materials we have nowadays, even if we were inclined to use them, just don't work that well for that kind of thing. And it's really not a healthy thing to be doing after we've just finished telling you over the last various shows how to bring wildlife into your garden, get beneficials and make places for birds. I don't really want you out there spraying your shrubs with insecticides. That's one of the first things we'll tell you. To increase beneficials, you stop using pesticides. So to the greatest extent possible, manage it mechanically or physically or by replacing the host species is really, in the long run, probably your best alternative.
Last Sunday, you had two cases of lace bug. Yeah. Now, being very clear, lace bug is not lace wing.
Correct. Lace bug is an insect that attacks, unfortunately, one of our California native shrubs, as well as some of its related plants. Lace bug is attacks toyon. People walked in with a leaf that was looking sort of scurfy on top, rough, discolored on top, as if it had spider mites. If you've ever seen a spider mite infestation, you know how they get that kind of dusty and as I say, a scurfy appearance. Flip it over, there were these things that looked like globs of resin, little things that looked dark and stuck on there real hard. Well, that's their excretion. And the lace bug itself generally isn't still present on the sample by the time it gets to my garden center, unless you put it in a bag or a jar. They're very attractive and interesting. So here's the thing about having grown up with a biologist for a mother. A pest problem was first an educational opportunity. And we had to look at the thing and look at it with a hand lens and get out the field guide to insects and figure out what it was. Then we could decide if we were going to kill it. But she was very curious about the insect itself. Well, I can tell you, lace bugs are really interesting. They're sort of, the body is the size of an aphid, but they have these lovely, elaborate wings, lacy wings, hence the name lace bug. Lace wing is a really cool beneficial insect with those gossamer green wings that you'll see around your porch light. And while they are primarily feeding on nectar and things, their larvae are very aggressive aphid eaters. Their larvae look like little antlion type things. They're that kind of dragon-like insect. That's a lace bug, a lace wing. We want them. Lace bugs.
And they will eat lace bugs.
Probably, yeah, I'd have to.
Well,
have
I have a picture here.
Oh, do you? Okay, good.
Yes. Okay. I've got the IPM website up, and it's talking all about lace bugs, giving me lots of information, including a picture that says, a green lace wing larva eating a lace bug nymph.
Yeah, it's basically an aphid.
Gross,
so anything that feeds on the other aphids and their relatives will probably feed on these. And as with anything in that group, much like aphids, you can blast them off. It seems that resiny stuff doesn't come off very readily. But if you've got that open in front of you, what is the website you're looking at?
UC. It is UCIPM is the name of the thing. Yep. And the name of the URL is ipm.ucanr.edu.
Right.
And then you'll have to just search for lace bug.
Lace bug, not lace wing necessarily. But they're going to manage them. If you had to spray, an oil spray would smother them. You'd have to get it on the undersides of the leaves. Of course, that would
smother. But it isn't going to do anything to the poop.
No, that'll still be there. The thing you'd be trying to do is stop the population from increasing. Well, of course, if you spray with anything, including oil, you'll also be smothering the beneficial things like the lace wings that are coming in and feeding on them, at least their larvae. So you have to make that trade-off. It vigorously rinsing the plant is helpful anyway. Just a reminder, we like to do this during the summer here in the Sacramento Valley, interior Southern California, East Bay, dry parts of California. Going out and washing plants off is a really important integral part of pest management. And so if these are becoming a problem on your toyon or your photinia, which is closely related to toyon, then you may wish to take that valve and put it on your hose and vigorously rinse off, which is going to be our answer to just about every pest problem during the course of the summer. It's a really simple way to manage it. Again, I've not seen this problem get so severe that it really compromises the health of the plant. It's just more of an appearance thing. And if you can just tolerate it and rinse the plant off, that'll probably be all you need to do.
You've been listening to the Davis Garden Show with Don Shore.
And Lois Richter here at KDRT LP 95.7 in Davis, California.